Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We human beings spend an awful lot of time and energy pursuing our primal urges and relatively little talking about or studying them. Well, that's about to change. Our guest, scientist-turned-science journalist Zoe Cormier's first book is a collection of surprising and amazing facts about the biology and neurochemistry of hedonism. It's called Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. And as debauched as the title is, the quest to satisfy these base instincts have led humans to groundbreaking discoveries. A note here that despite making her case for the redemptive power of these reprobate topics, Zoe and I will be talking about some body parts and things that could make some people squeamish or might be unsuitable for children. And with that, Zoe Cormier, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
Humans chase after sexual pleasure, narcotics of many stripes, and music across all cultures. We're united in this. Does hedonism make us human?
It's part of what makes us human. So normally when scientists and philosophers think about what is it that demarcates us from the rest of the animal kingdom, they tend to focus on our higher cognitive capacities, such as the ability to do mathematics, the capacity for language, the ability to think about the past, present, and future, all of these things that we think of as higher functions of our consciousness. In fact, in our name, Homo sapiens, that means the Latin for wise man. You know, so we tend to think about ourselves as being clever and, you know, the monkey that thinks. And so taking drugs and engaging in sexual activity and making music have tended to be denigrated as primitive or basic because all other animals do reproduce and indulge in narcotic plants and make noise. But if you take a closer look at these three activities, you find that we actually have taken all of them to the next level. And in terms of our anatomy, in terms of our behavior, in terms of our communicative output with sound, we have taken all of these activities to a new plane. And they are integral to what defines our species just as much as the capacity to think about the past or to be able to write things down.
Human bodies are built for gaining pleasure from sex. That's one of the things revealed in your book. So what are some of the biological and neurological characteristics that make that true? Let's start with women.
For one, breasts are unique in the animal kingdom, in fact. Only humans have swollen glands like these that are swollen all the time. Whereas if you look at other primates, for example, they have similar tissue, but it only swells when they're breastfeeding. And then other animals, such as cows, they have sort of like a big bag of milk. Ours are completely distinct, and that's quite significant. They think that it could serve as a visual attractor. And certainly, can I use the...
The word that rhymes with Dolores.
Yes, the word that rhymes with Dolores. I'm very happy to talk about the clitoris. The clitoris is the only part of the human anatomy that is designed for pleasure alone and only pleasure. And it appears to be the only organ in all of the animal kingdom, although, you know, you'd have to know what it feels like to be a sea slug to know if this is true. But it seems to be the only biological body part that is built for pleasure alone.
How about for men? What distinguishes the male sex organ, especially from other mammals? We are the only species in which a man has a bone in his sex organ, which means what? That the brain has to be involved?
Exactly. So almost all other mammals have bones in their penises. So dogs, cats, and even our closest relatives, chimpanzees, have bones in their penises. So the fact that other factors are required to get it up and to keep it up means that other issues are more important, such as what goes on in the brain. And that clearly arousal in the mind is a really important facet of our biology.
Well, the desire to have sex drove a number of innovations in birth control. What are some of those early forms that were used by people who wanted to have sex without getting pregnant?
Oh, you name it, they tried it. Before we had the latex condom, for example, which was originally developed in 1890 out of vulcanized rubber, condoms were made from a wide variety of materials, from oiled paper to linen to, of course, sheep's bladder. If you look it up, there's even a few tortoiseshell condoms that have been made.
It doesn't sound very comfortable.
No. And then in terms of barrier methods, which would be insertion into the female, a number of very unsavory and strange materials, from honey to lemons cut in half, like a diaphragm, crocodile dung. It says a lot about the desire to have sex without the threat of conception.
And there have also been some accidental innovations. You write about the testing phase of what was to become Viagra, first proposed as a treatment for jet lag. What happened there?
The jet lag cure, Viagra, was originally tested for altitude sickness because what it does is it acts on the blood vessels and it prevents blood from escaping your veins and your arteries. And so your blood vessels have a lot to do with why you feel sick after you've flown, because you've gone up in the air and come down. And Viagra happened to have this interesting side effect. And when the scientists who were researching it wanted to halt the trial, the men involved in the trial very largely said, "Oh, really not, please." And the rest is history. But prior to Viagra, there were many attempts at creating pharmaceutical interventions that didn't work. So the fact that this one was stumbled upon by accident shows us that the scientific method, we often would like to think that it's a matter of, you know, hypothesis, data, you know, finding, conclusion. But often amazing discoveries happen by accident.
Well, this is similarly, LSD was developed as a tool for preventing excessive bleeding. And in turn,
yes,
the use of LSD led to Watson and Crick discerning the structure for DNA. Tell us that story.
So Albert Hofmann, who created LSD, we like to think of most people who come up with narcotics as being weirdos in, you know, in their sheds messing around with chemicals, such as Alexander Shulgin. But Hofmann was a nerd. He was a Swiss nerd, and he spent his entire career working for Sandoz in the mountains of Switzerland. And prior to coming up with LSD, he spent 10 years working on treatments to prevent death by postpartum hemorrhaging. And in fact, he created something called Methergine, which is still one of the most widely used drugs in obstetrics. He spent most of his career trying to save the lives of pregnant women. And then one day he had this chemical that he had made, LSD-25. And something about that molecule, it had sat on a laboratory shelf for about 5 years since he first synthesized it. Something about it drew him back to it. And he went and he brought out the solution and he got a bit on his fingers. And the rest is history. Leading on from this, we're not entirely sure if Watson and Crick discovered the shape of DNA, because it was just a rumor. But they were known to be party animals. And there was a journalist who said that Crick had told him that he had gotten his insight into the structure of DNA while on LSD. But we'll never really know. We do know that a guy named Carey Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for coming up with something called the polymerase chain reaction, which is basically a method of reading DNA. We know that he got his incredible insight into how DNA could be read while on LSD because he wrote about it in his autobiography.
As a co-founder of Guerrilla Science, Zoe Cormier has helped create live events and installations that connect people to the wonders of science. Well, we're talking with her about her book, Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. It's a collection of surprising and revealing research into the biology and neurochemistry of the human pursuit of pleasure and checking out and rocking out. No, of course, Zoe Cormier, we can understand the biological urge to mate, but human beings experimenting with mind alteration and transcendence, they've been doing this for thousands of years. So something else is at play. What are they looking for?
Ooh, what are they looking for? People who experiment. That's a very good question, and that's not necessarily something I can answer from a scientific perspective, but I guess just anecdotally, when, you know, you talk to people about why they would do these things. I would say that narcotic use is one of the most puzzling facets of human biology, and it's incredibly pervasive, and certainly when you see the bad side of chemical addiction and reliance and misuse, it's absolutely heartbreaking. So what is it that draws us to do these things? Some psychiatrists who work with drugs call them medicaments for the human condition, which I think is a good way of putting it. So when you talk about things like opiates and painkillers or caffeine or alcohol to alleviate stress, that kind of makes more sense when you think about it that way. As for psychedelics and the transcendental hallucinogenic lysergic explosion, each would, I think, would give you their own story. But beware, most people's stories about their own drug use tend to be really boring. Mm.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned addiction, which is, of course, such a serious problem. But you're talking about effects on human beings. But there have also been experiments giving various kind of drugs to spiders. How did this affect the webs that they spun?
These were funded by NASA, believe it or not. And in order to get a rough idea of the toxicity of a certain chemical, they decided to fund some experiments that gave drugs to spiders, which seemed very practical because, A, people aren't going to care so much if a spider dies as opposed to, say, a chimpanzee or an elephant, which, I mean, there's a recorded case of an elephant being given LSD and dying. B, they're easy to acquire and breed and make tons of them. And see, you can get an idea of what's going on in the nervous system based on what happens to the web. Whether or not it's an accurate representation of what goes on in the human body, at the time they thought it was a rough indicator of how dangerous something could be. So you can very easily Google image this, NASA spiders drugs. The web on marijuana is pretty competent, but it looks like the spider just gave up halfway through. The web made on caffeine is interestingly the weirdest. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And the web made on LSD is pretty much perfect in its geometric proportions, but it's distinctively broader.
Well, that's the case of spiders, but we do know that many people suffering from mental illness do mask their symptoms with drugs or reach for drugs. They're trying to get something, a particular kind of neurotransmitter. They're looking for a different feeling. What is that connection between what we know about mind-altering drugs and brain science?
One of the most interesting things that I uncovered in my research was the ways that drugs led to the discovery of neurotransmitters. So neurotransmitters are the chemical messengers in the mind that the body uses for neurons to talk to each other. And so you can think of them like chemical packages that are chucked between cells, like cargo between two ships. Basically, we discovered drugs and understood their chemical structure sometimes more than 150 years before we then found the neurotransmitter that drugs mimic. So basically, the question in the 19th century, as the neuroscience and the chemistry and the understanding of drugs was starting to flourish, the question was, how can a chemical made by a plant, such as opium made by poppy, caffeine made by tea, how can these chemicals create an effect within the human body? What is the mechanism by which that would work? And the ways that drugs work is they mimic our neurotransmitters. So the chemicals in opium mimic what are called our endorphins. But we understood the structure of the drugs many years before we understood the structure of the neurotransmitter. So the first time this happened was with nicotine. And they mapped the structure of nicotine in the 1800s. And they tracked down the neurotransmitter that it mimics in the 1960s, and they called it the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. We named our own body part after nicotine.
A drug.
After a drug. And in fact, the opium was first mapped in about 1805, and it was 1970 when they found the endorphins that it mimics.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Zoe Cormier. She's author of the book Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, The Science of Hedonism and the Hedonism of Science. And we'll continue our conversation with a look at the role that drugs played in the rise of rock and roll. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll is all my brain and body need. Sex and drugs and rock and roll.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's the subject of Zoe Cormier's first book, which is a collection of surprising and revealing research into the biology and neurochemistry of the pursuit of pleasure. Earlier, we talked about how drugs alter the brain, and that's where we're picking up the conversation, because history has shown us that where there are drugs, music is not far away. That's because music and drugs tickle the same neural networks in the brain. So I asked Zoe if humans are hardwired to love and get lost in music.
Absolutely. We're wired from birth for music. In fact, every single person in the world is born with perfect pitch.
Really, although you point out that a number of people, as much as 4% of the population, suffer from amusia, which means they can't hear music at all. So it's all just noise. Why would that be?
It's because it requires every part of your brain working in concert together to create the sensation of music. And if any one of those bits of the brain isn't necessarily working in exactly the same fashion as it does in the general population, you can have a slight breakdown in your ability to comprehend music the way that other people do. But there are many different kinds of amusia. There's about a dozen forms that have been identified. And not everybody who has amusia dislikes music entirely. Some people still enjoy rhythm, for example, even if they can't perceive timbre and pitch. But people who have amusia, they don't tend to realize that they're different to everybody else because it's not like color blindness, for example. It's not something that you can as easily test for. And they mostly just tend to be a bit bemused or confused by why everybody else likes these weird sounds. And it was really only in the past 20 years that scientists, particularly working at McGill in Montreal, started to get a good understanding of how common this is.
Hmm. Well, there's much evidence that we have of musicians creating under the influence. Billie Holiday, the Beatles, the Grateful Dead, Miles Davis, David Bowie, Aphex Twins. But there's been very little real scientific study of the role that drugs may play in musical experimentation. And why is that?
Practically speaking, it's not really going to get you any funding. If you want to get funding to look at, say, treatments using marijuana to treat multiple sclerosis, that's much more likely to appeal to an eagle-eyed funder than asking for money to smoke pot and listen to Bob Marley and to see what happens to your brain. But that being said, they did very recently in England, in fact, Channel 4 paid for an analysis of what happens in the minds of people who are smoking cannabis and their desire to listen to music. And they found that the desire to listen to music increases rapidly and just dramatically. And it has a lot to do with something called what's called the salience network. But it's interesting that this study was undertaken at the behest of a television station and not a university because, well, they're more likely to have more freedom with their cash, aren't they?
How about not just those who are creating, but the response among listeners? You know, why, for example, is ketamine and MDMA so popular within the electronic dance music world, for example?
It's the ketamine being a tranquilizer certainly can make the enjoyment of repetitive beats very pleasing. I mean, everybody who does these drugs, who enjoys these kinds of dance music, can give you their own reason. Certainly the capacity to stay up all night with tons of energy has to play a certain role. But sometimes, you know, for a lot of music, whether you're looking at psychedelia in the 70s and people taking acid, or if you look at the pace of punk being sped up when people started to do more speed, you can find these casual links between people's emotive state and the musical output that they enjoy or create.
How about the question of whether we are indeed meant to be monogamous? Is there any kind of research that can conclusively say yes or no?
I would say, based on my research, that there is no research that conclusively says yes or no. I would say that, if anything, the study of the human species teaches us that diversity is the norm. Some people are gay, some people are straight, some people like both. And in terms of monogamy, there's probably no other subject of human sexuality that has been subjected to so much scrutiny and aggrandization, but also belittlement. So for, you know, every study by a scientist claiming that monogamy is the natural state for human sexuality, you have other scientists who claim that it's nothing but a political construct. The problem is that people don't approach the study of sex the same way that they do the study of, say, stars or grass. People bring their prejudices and their pain and their preconceived ideas to the table, and it often warps the findings that they come up with because they already have in mind an idea of what they want to find.
Well, sex and drugs and rock and roll were put together for a reason by Ian Dury and the Blockheads from the song, "It's All My Brain and Body Needs," if I remember. And in your book, what is it that we can learn about being human from studying them, Zoe Cormier?
First of all, these are not aspects of the human condition that we should try to repress because we think they're sinful. These are aspects of our condition that are universal and are genuinely important to the way our species is the way it is. That doesn't mean we should spend all day sitting around getting high and listening to music, but it means that doing so now and then can be a meaningful experience. I think it's quite funny. I researched for this book for 3 years, and my mother summed up 3 years of scientific research in one sentence. Most fun things in life are bad for you, but nothing will kill you faster than having no fun at all.
Zoe Cormier, journalist, photographer, science writer, co-founder of Guerrilla Science, and now author of Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, The Science of Hedonism and the Hedonism of Science. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.